Hello, it's Friday, February the 26th. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up. Why is it men are more likely than women to be struggling with their mental health during the lockdown? The Supreme Court says the jihadi bride, Shamima Begum, can't come back to Britain to appeal her case. Good. Also, we're talking about the extraordinary war of words between Alex Salmond, the former First Minister of Scotland, and Nicola Sturgeon, the SNP's successor as First Minister of Scotland. Has there ever been a Prime Minister and predecessor feud quite like it? But first, Her Majesty the Queen. Don't you just love her? She's stepped into the row over why people will or won't have vaccines, saying everyone should have the vaccine. If they don't, they're being selfish. How can anybody disagree with that? The Queen has made a pretty extraordinary intervention, it has to be said, in the drive to get more people vaccinated against coronavirus, saying that people with doubts about the vaccine should get on with it and think about other people rather than themselves. The 94-year-old monarch and her husband was vaccinated last month, and she said the jab didn't hurt at all and made her feel protected. I'm joined now by Ingrid Seward, who is the editor-in-chief of Majesty magazine. Ingrid, she is so down, in her own way, she just speaks such down-to-earth common sense, doesn't she?
She certainly does. And I think when you see her on this Zoom call to the NHS chiefs, it's almost as if she's talking to you in a room. It's not like her giving a speech to television. It's much more intimate than that. And therefore, what she says has a huge resonance.
And it's really significant, isn't it? Because she's head of the Commonwealth, so those words will be beamed all around the Commonwealth. In fact, they'll be beamed all around the world because she is the Queen, of course. And we know, Ingrid, that a lot of the problem in this country with the take-up is people from the black and ethnic minority community. So she will be hoping that people in that community listen to what she says.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that people do listen to what she says, especially older people. I think they can draw great comfort from the fact that, you know, she is encouraging people to, you know, to get this vaccine done. And then in a sort of almost, you know, motherly way, she's saying, well, you know, it's a little bit selfish, really, if you don't do it, because, other, you know, it could affect other people. So it's sort of very gentle, but very firm.
And it's, I mean, some people are saying it's quite unusual for her. It's not unusual in some respects, because I can remember after the financial crash, I think she was at the London School of Economics, and she simply said to the head of it, why did none of you see it coming? And she, again, just spoke for the whole country, not the world. Why did nobody know that our banks were on the verge of failure?
Yes, I do remember that very well. I love that. Why didn't anyone see this coming? Yes.
Yeah.
So she does. I mean, the Queen does actually speak her mind. I think probably more so in her older age than obviously she did when she was younger, and she was very, very cautious about what she said. But it is unusual for her to make such a bold statement as this, because she doesn't normally, you know, sort of stray into an area of controversy. That's not her normal mode, but this time she has, and it's extremely successful when she does do it.
And now on the subject of the royals, Ingrid, we can't barely go a day or two when Prince Harry, who of course went to the United States to lead an ordinary life and get his privacy back, he's now given an interview to James Corden on the top of an open-air bus, and apparently it's all the press's fault that he's now living in the United States.
Well, I know. I just wish he would. I would wish he would stop blaming the press, us, all of us, you know, for his own misery. I just think it's a bit naive, and you know, he said in this interview with Corden that it really had got to him. And he had a real issue with it. Well, we know that, but he has a real issue with the press, and he feels harassed by them. And you know, there he is, sort of giving interviews. So, and you know, and of course, it's going to create more controversy. If he'd just gone to LA and just stayed under the radar, I think we probably would have had a bit more sympathy Don't you think that?
I do, I do. And the trouble is with James Corden, so thrilled to get the interview. It was all very chummy. He didn't say to Prince Harry, yeah, I get you a bit cross with the press and you want your privacy back, Harry, but how come then you and your wife released that very moody, atmospheric photograph of your the fact that you're expecting your second child, her holding her bump, him with no shoes or socks on, oddly, which was released to the Demon Press?
Well, exactly. But you see, I think that, Harry and Meghan are all about control. They didn't like the press when they were here because they couldn't control them, because we have a wonderful free press. Well, not as free as it was, but we up to a point we do. And I think it's because it's all about control, because they like putting out these whimsical pictures and little statements to a favoured few. And they said they were going to do this. But of course, it doesn't stay with the favoured few. The favoured few might put it out, but then, of course, it's everywhere. And it makes the rest of the press feel, you know, aggravated and irritated by them.
That's Ingrid Seward, who is, of course, editor-in-chief of Majesty magazine. So why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to the Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Alex Salmon, the former Scottish First Minister, is being questioned by Scottish members of Parliament over his claims of a, quote, malicious and concerted conspiracy against him relating to mishandle sexual harassment complaints against him. Just to remind you, of course, he was up in court last year, cleared of all charges of sexual harassment against a number of women. The Scottish government had to pay him £500,000 towards his legal costs after they mishandled the complaints against him. The First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has said there's not a shred of evidence to support the accusations against her government, and she's going to give evidence next week. I'm joined now by Douglas Ross, leader of the Scottish Conservative Party, and he's the MP for Moray. Douglas Ross, I've been covering politics for a very long time, and we all know about feuds between prime ministers and their predecessors. Think Mrs. Thatcher and Ted Heath. Think Gordon Brown, Tony Blair. Never in my experience have I seen or heard any feud with the ferocity of the one between Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon. And remember, we all know that Nicola Sturgeon was his great friend and protege.
Absolutely. She said on a number of occasions that Alex Salmond was her mentor, and they were clearly close over a number of decades at the top of the Scottish National Party, and she was his deputy first minister during the administration of the SNP from 2007 to 2014. So they were so close. They were interlinked through their politics and their desire to separate Scotland from the rest of the UK. And now we are seeing in full light this scandal that has got worse and worse in Scotland, the sleaze at the heart of this SNP government coming to a head with the former SNP leader and First Minister of Scotland accusing the current SNP leader and First Minister of Scotland of lying.
And she used extraordinary, a press conference yesterday, as he's made the point today, he used a press conference about COVID to attack him, whether that's appropriate or not, when she's got her opportunity next week. But she says that what he's saying about a conspiracy, there's not a shred of evidence. The trouble is, for us to judge would be very difficult, because the evidence he presented on the Scottish Parliament website detailing all his claims against her and her government, it was then withdrawn, that evidence, by the Scottish government and put back with the key phrases redacted. So difficult for us to conclude whether the First Minister, Mrs. Sturgeon, is telling the truth.
Well, a few things here. First of all, Nicola Sturgeon has used these COVID briefings to get party political for months now, and we need the BBC to get a handle of that. It's ridiculous that she continues to stand up and make party political points on what should be a public health briefing. But in terms of the evidence that had to be taken down from the Scottish Parliament website and then redacted, that was at the instruction and after threats from the Crown Office. The Lord Advocate, who is a political appointment, Nicola Sturgeon appointed this Lord Advocate, and there is a real now blurring between the roles of the Crown and the government in Scotland, and I think that's really worrying. But also, it's not just that one occasion. I think there's now over 50 occasions where the Scottish government and the SNP have tried to really block the passage of evidence for this inquiry to get to the root of the problem, to find some answers. Why are they blocking things on over 50 occasions? Why have they failed to respect two votes in the Scottish Parliament that the Scottish Conservatives put forward, where the SNP were defeated? They were told they had to provide evidence, and they're still not even respecting the will of Parliament. What have they got to hide? What is Nicola Sturgeon scared of?
Now, if Alex Salmond will make his claims today, accusing her of misleading Parliament and lying to Parliament. Now, many years ago, Douglas Ross, that used to be a very serious charge. If he can make it stick against her, though, does she have to resign?
Well, it's not just Alex Salmond. And look, I'm no fan of Alex Salmond. You know, I don't believe in his politics, and I think he's done some absolutely despicable things. But as well as this inquiry, which is looking at the Scottish Government's handling of complaints, and we know the Court of Session found the Scottish Government had acted unfairly, unlawfully, and with apparent bias, but there's also a separate independent ministerial code inquiry that's being conducted into potential breaches by Nicola Sturgeon. And I think if there is any confirmation that she has lied to Parliament, and I believe there is now mounting evidence that she has, she's misled MSPs and the Scottish public, then her position is untenable. She cannot continue. And indeed, Nicola Sturgeon, as a senior member of the SNP back in the day, was one of the ones calling for former Scottish Labour First Minister Henry McLeish to resign, and he subsequently did over a far less important issue than we're discussing now. You know, it was a far less serious offence that he was accused of that the First Minister is currently accused of, and her position would not be sustainable if she's been found guilty of lying.
Just finally, is the problem partly for politicians trying to cut through this? It's an incredibly complicated story with allegations here and allegations there. And there was the court case which the Scottish Government had where Alex Salmond got all his legal costs paid. Is the worry that people in Scotland in particular, Mr. Ross, turn off because they just think this is noises off, this is two former allies turning on each other with a vengeance, and it's become deeply personal, and the detail, the point about this gets lost in the war of words?
Well, it is difficult to follow. It's a complex story, and there's accusation and counter-accusation, which does make it difficult to really have any cut through with the public. But I think we've seen, certainly over the past few weeks and indeed the last couple of months, that not just on this story, but there are so many incidents that 14 years of failure from the SNP is starting to cut through. People can see they haven't changed politics like they said they would in Scotland. They are guilty of sleaze and corruption at the very top levels of the SNP and the Scottish Government. And people really need to consider that, because it's quite clear that someone is lying in all this. Either it's the person who last tried to make Scotland an independent country and led that campaign, Alex Salmond, or it's the person that currently wants to try and separate Scotland from the rest of the UK, Nicola Sturgeon. They can't both be telling the truth.
I think you're right, but certainly can't. That's Douglas Ross, who is the leader of the Scottish Conservative Party. So if you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, why don't you subscribe to us? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. You can also get in touch by tweeting us at Mel Plus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. The Supreme Court has ruled today that the so-called jihadi bride Shamima Begum should not be allowed to return to the United Kingdom to pursue an appeal against the removal of her British citizenship. Begum left the UK aged 15 with a couple of friends to join the Islamic State group as a teenager, and is now currently in a camp in northern Syria. I'm joined now by Emma Webb, who's Associate Fellow at the think tank Civitas, who specialises in extremism. I've got to say, Emma, on a personal level, I'm relieved and delighted this ghastly creature isn't coming back to Britain.
I would agree with you completely there. I think that this is an almost shockingly sensible decision from the Supreme Court. They've put national security above, not so much above her right to a fair trial. She still has the ability to appeal from Al Vosh camp, which is where she currently is living in Syria. So in that sense, her right to a fair trial isn't being breached in any way. The judge at the Supreme Court said that potentially her hearing could be stayed until she's able to participate properly in the process. So she still has a right to a fair appeal. And it's just completely the right decision to put the Home Secretary's decision to put the public safety first above the rights the desire of somebody who knowingly chose to go and join a genocidal terrorist state, and in that sense sort of gave up her we could say her moral citizenship.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at the very powerful intervention from Sir James Edie QC, who represented the Home Secretary in court, who said quite simply, she married an IS fighter, she lived in Raqqa, the capital of their self-declared caliphate, remained with them for 4 years. When she left when the last pocket of IS territory collapsed. She said, individuals who went to Syria to join us pose a real and serious risk to national security, whatever sympathy might be generated by the age when they travelled. And that the Supreme Court accepted unanimously.
Yeah, absolutely. She was 15. We have to remember she was 15 when she chose to travel, which is comfortably above the age of criminal responsibility in the UK. She also chose to travel at a time when we had already seen all of the gruesome imagery was already coming out of Islamic State propaganda machine. We knew of all of the aid workers and journalists who had been beheaded, and we knew that they were committing genocide in Syria and Iraq, and the sorts of things that they have done to the people of Iraq and Syria are absolutely obscene. And the evidence suggests that she was involved in the morality police there, which is a pretty brutal group. And it's not. This is not just about Begum. This is also about the precedent that it would set. There are currently 20 either former or currently British citizens still in Syria under the Kurdish authorities there. And this is a precedent that is to do with national security. And so I think we need to remember that she is not the victim here. We shouldn't be having any sympathy for her. The reason why she decided that she wanted to return to the UK wasn't for any, you know, she didn't seem to be particularly, feeling guilty about what she had done going there. She chose to return because the project of Islamic State had failed. And morally speaking, I don't think we should have any sympathy for her. We should have sympathy for the people, the Yazidis, the people of Iraq and Syria, who were persecuted and genocided under the rule of Islamic State. She's not a victim.
Yeah, and if there are 15-year-olds I feel sorry for, Emma, it's not her. It's the 15-year-olds who went to the Ariana Grande concert at Manchester Arena and lost their lives because of an IS bomb.
Exactly. And also the people in Iraq and Syria, people who were affected by the morality police that she was apparently a part of, and the Yazidi women and children who were sold into sex slavery by Islamic State. You know, there are still people who are missing because of what Shamima Begum was a part of there. And I think that, you know, we have to remember that if she were to return here in order to appeal her case, the likelihood of us being able to get rid of her once she is here, if her citizenship isn't given back to her, the chances of us being able to make her leave the country are exceptionally slim. And even if we were to try her in this country for her involvement in Islamic State, the prosecution levels of returning fighters is extremely low. We've had maybe over 400 people return so far, and the prosecutions are in the tens. So, and particularly amongst women who were involved in Islamic State, because this is the crimes that they're complicit in are the crimes of the state that they went to build. So, you know, some of them did carry weapons, of course, but they were involved in other ways and committed crimes in other senses. And it's very difficult, particularly because of the fact that, you know, faces are covered and so on. It's very difficult to collect evidence in a conflict zone, particularly after the fact, as we, you know, the situation that we are now in. The chances of her actually being prosecuted here, if she were to stay, are just exceptionally slim. So justice, the chances of justice being done in the UK are slim to none, I think.
I couldn't agree with you more. Emma, thanks for joining us. That's Emma Webb. She's an associate fellow at the think tank Civitas, specialising in extremism. And that is Shamima Begum has lost the latest stage of her battle to come back to Britain. Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicholls joins me now with the latest from the sports news. Tim, if I blinked, I would have missed the England second innings in the Test match against India. Bit of a disaster, wasn't it? What's the fallout today?
Well, that is an understatement. And to be honest, if you'd have blinked, you might have missed the whole test. It was the shortest test since 1935 involving any team in terms of the number of deliveries bowled. But yes, England's second innings was pretty shambolic, even by their standards. I mean, look, there is obviously plenty of fallout, and you know, there's been a lot of talk in the aftermath. The fact is, it was not a fair contest between bat and ball. The pitch wasn't up to test standard, but ultimately, England weren't good enough. You know, when you win the toss and collapse like England did on the first day, you know, they were out for 112. It is simply not enough. The batsmen did not perform well enough in either innings. But, you know, it was a funny game because despite the pitch being, you know, not really up to standard, it's obviously the same for both teams. And England did incredibly well with the ball in the first innings to bowl India out for 145. And you know, actually gave them a chance which nobody would have expected after England's first innings to come back and win the match. But I'm afraid they were pretty hopeless in that second innings, bowled out for 81, and India sort of coasted to victory in the end. But I mean, the fact that Joe Root, who is a very much a part-time spinner, he's England captain, but he's a batsman. You know, first and foremost, he's a batsman. He turns his arm over a little now and again. He took 5 wickets for 8 runs against some of the best players in the world at spin bowling. It just shows you the sort of farcical nature of the match. But the two Indian spinners, Patel and Ashwin, were superb. You know, you can't take anything away from the way India bowled and deservedly won the match. There's no question about that. They're 2-1 up in the series now. You'd be a very, very brave person to bet against India wrapping up the series 3-1 when that's the next test starts on Thursday. But, you know, there's so much fallout from this, Andrew, because ultimately England have got a year of playing more cricket than they've ever had to play before. They're juggling all sorts of, you know, series home and away. There's the T20 World Cup in Australia last year, and they've come in for some criticism for the way they've gone about things. They've rested and rotated players. Johnny Bairstow, who came in for this test match, he hadn't played in the first 2 tests in India after doing well in Sri Lanka earlier this winter. He was out for a pair, so he got no runs in either innings. He's a number 3 batsman. But, you know, my view is that England should have prioritised the Ashes, this tour in India, and the T20 World Cup this year. They've not done that because they've tried to sort of spread the load evenly across. You know, they've got obviously 3 test series this summer as well. Sri Lanka, that they've been at Sri Lanka already this winter. They've got the Ashes at the end of the year, as well as the T20 World Cup in Australia in October. So there's an awful lot to cram in, plus the IPL, which obviously is a big payday for the players. But I think, I know that, you know, far better informed people like me, I know Kevin Peterson was saying the same on TalkSport, that you really got to, you know, manage the workload better than England have, because they've, you know, Moeen Ali, we had the problem after the last test where he was sent home, and we knew he was going to be sent home, but it was clunky language from the England captain Joe Root about sort of that he chose to go home when it had all been pre-agreed, as they've agreed with every England player. This is going to be your workload this year, because, as I say, it is an unprecedented year for the number of matches across all formats that England are going to play. But England in India is a huge, huge tour. It's, other than the Aussies, it's the biggest one for England. And to go out there with, you know, without being able to pick the strongest team for every test match, I think was a misstep by England. I appreciate it's unprecedented, and they've got to, you know, they've got to be careful, because where they don't want the players to be burnt out. But it's a real shame, because, and particularly, we talked about this before, Andrew, this test series was on terrestrial TV. It was a great opportunity for people to really watch some cricket. And it was over in 5 sessions. It was over in 2 days. It didn't even go the distance of 2 days. You know, it's still, they should be playing all weekend. They're not. It's a real shame for terrestrial cricket fans. And it's a real shame for England, because that was a really disappointing performance. But you've got to give credit to India. They handled the conditions far better than England.
All right, that's Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicholls with the continuing fallout from that test, humiliating test defeat to India. So have men been hit hardest by the loneliness of this wretched pandemic? The psychotherapist Noel McDermott says that men have found it harder to adapt to socialising at a distance, leaving them more isolated. He says men tend to get their social interaction in structured settings such as sports, work, pints in the pub, which is why they've been struggling during the lockdown. He joins me now. Is that true of most men, do you think, Noel, or just a lot of men? Because we do know there's all sorts of evidence that men have been struggling in this lockdown.
I think it's still culturally very true of men that what you introduce in terms of men get their social support through activities together and social activities together is very true, not just in the UK, but it's much broader than that as well. So in other countries around the globe, it tends to be true, a cross-cultural phenomenon. And it is also true because of that, that those areas where men do get social support have literally shut down in most places, except for places like, you know, Australia, which has closed its borders and still living relatively normally.
I'm thinking also a lot of men, of course, go to the gym. They play football after work or in the lunch break. All of that has stopped, of course. And of course, a lot of men are now at home having to help out with the housework, home teaching and all the rest that goes with it.
A lot of guys I've talked to have really welcomed working from home. And particularly the guys that are further up the management chain have really welcomed working from home and not intending to go back. So they've really, really, where there's a family, men are reporting they're really, really liking that. But there's an overdependence on that family dynamic. And one thing we always try and teach men, for example, when they first become fathers, is don't imagine you can get everything from your partner and your children. You have to have a support network out of that, because being a parent, being a husband, you require additional support. Women do that automatically, you know, the National Child.
Why is that, though? But why is that? Why is it an automatic pilot issue for a woman and not a man?
Yeah, I'm using the wrong word. I think it's a culturally determined issue. That from a very early age, certain types of activities girls are guided to, and certain types of activities guys are guided to. And guys tend to get guided to those activities where there are specific outcomes where they can get approval from, whereas girls tend to be guided to those activities where there aren't specific outcomes, such as socialisation and social groups.
Does that just mean women are much, much more sensible than we blokes?
They're much more natural in their interaction, because actually that's what we're designed to do with social animals. So our emotional and intellectual and physical health is improved the better our social connections. Yeah. And so women tend to be sort of a lot healthier in that sense, although they will report more incidents of depression and anxiety. But again, there's a cultural issue that women will talk about these things. Guys tend to, they tend to downplay when they're struggling psychologically and emotionally, which is why one of the reasons why guys tend to have very serious problems, because they sort of say, no, I'm fine, until they're in a deep, dark hole. And when there's very few options left to them.
And it's a figure that always surprises me, Noel. One of the biggest causes of death for men under 35 is still suicide, because men are will not talk about these problems.
Yeah. And, you know, that when you start including single occupancy deaths in cars, then the figure goes even higher. Because,
does
of course,
really?
One of the things that men do is that they choose ways of attempting suicide that are pretty permanent, whereas women will choose ways of attempting suicide that are less permanent. So an overdose of pills, which takes some time, is typically what a woman would do. But jumping in a car and smashing it at 90 miles an hour into a wall is typically what a guy will do. And one way of doing it is much more dangerous and much more final than another. So it is, I know, shocking when you hear that, and it's still the case. And additionally, and I mean, you know, I don't want to over-egg this, but I do want to make this point. Additionally, we know that when you have large numbers of unemployed people, the suicide rate increases. There's almost a one-to-one relationship. So for every 1% increase in unemployment, there's a 0.8% increase in suicide. So it's an almost one-to-one relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Just finally, Noel, if somebody, particularly a guy, is feeling very down, who's listening to this, maybe because of lockdown, they haven't been able to go to work, they haven't seen their colleagues, their mates, all that sort of thing, and they are feeling down, what should they do?
Well, the basic rule about getting over any mental health problem is rejoining social support. Okay, so we've got lots of psychotherapy you can do, and that's great. But really, the point of psychotherapy is to get people living a social life. Okay? And that's what most psychotherapy is about. It's encouraging people to re-engage in social. So the first thing to do is pick up the phone and start talking to people. If there's nobody on your list of people that you can talk to, you can start talking to the Samaritans, for example. And that's a great way to start beginning to practice reaching out. Phone your GP. Tell them that you're feeling low. They won't be surprised, you know. And they won't be like, oh, really? That's unusual. They'll be like, great, thanks for calling me. Every single GP in the UK is really primed for when men reach out for help, and they'll make sure you get it because you will be in the minority, I promise you. So they won't be overloaded by it. There are specialist mental health services as well that you can get referred into. There's a thing very briefly called IAPT, IAPT, Increased Access to Psychological Therapies, which is an NHS thing, free. If you Google IAPT plus the name of your local authority, it'll take you to a website usually called whatever, Camden Wellbeing Services or whatever it is, your area. And you can self-refer into that if you're having struggles, and they will help you free. Within a week, they'll have assessed you. Within a few weeks, 4 weeks, or 4 or 5 weeks, they'll have you seeing a therapist, etc., and using evidence-based services. So if I get any message across to people, it's reach out, make those calls, step through that doorway into help. The evidence is once guys get through that doorway, then they use the help really well, but it's just getting through that initial reaching out bit.
That's the psychotherapist Noah McDermott with very important advice there. So guys, don't suffer at home. Think about what you can do about it. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend and good night.